skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide. And I bought out a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, immigration, activation, and it is obligation to my nation. That's what the world is today.
Show on K108, heard every Sunday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. If you have questions for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. Another lovely day, and freeways are still open, and enabled me to get here, and I felt pretty special. You can call and let me know if I'm not, if I had the wrong opinion, but I was driving in and I saw those blue lights blocking all the intersection. I thought, how important am I today? But, you know, we just never know how great we are, do we? Anyway, so much for APEC, and I wonder if the streets are clean, will they stay that way? Well, the city officials and state officials, and I guess the one thing that bothers me about APEC, and I'm not going to object to much of it, but our leaders here are, I feel bad in that the guys that's watching, the legislators and the managers of the city and the state, they're in good with these guys, and half of them, I think about Hanneman, he's not been prosecuted yet. Harris, Jeremy Harris, he didn't get prosecuted. And as you know, I talked about a while back, the House legislator, John Mizuno, having hired his wife. Well, Mr. Calvin Say actually called me up after the show and wanted a meeting. I did meet with him last Tuesday. And the meeting consisted of him wanting to tell me once again he wasn't going to change his mind and that it was left up to the legislators to hire their wives if they chose to. And what I did mention the last time, I hadn't really confirmed it, but Joey Manahan, the Vice Speaker of the House, has his wife working for him there at the office. So, you know, in the old days, they say that government and business decisions were made at the bar and on the golf course. Well, now apparently it's made at home on the pillow. So I don't know what to tell you, but Manahan, I wanted to get him on the show and ask him some questions, but he didn't have time. He said he was busy with APEC. So I guess he's going to make sure he and his wife get to get a good job. Anyway, I got a caller. I'll see here what we got. Good morning, caller. Comment or question?
Yes. When they're trying to discern the worth, the value, the benefit of APEC, I get to weigh, on the one hand, you know, what you hear coming over the television, right, from Carlisle and Shots and there's many more.
Mm-hmm. Well,
these men, I don't think have done their due diligence on the subject, really. Mm-hmm. And because on the other hand, I get to weigh the observations of a UH sociology professor who has been looking at APEC since the 90s. So in judging between the two, when the sociology professor says, yeah, it's good for some, but for many others, it's no good.
Yeah, well, APEC is...
It's pretty clear to me, you know, which side is more credible.
Right.
Yeah?
Well, I just say what's troublesome in the immediate sense is that these same leaders that have wrecked our economy here locally, and the streets are, you know, you can't drive up and down the streets without breaking your car, and the fuel costs, and on and on and on, and yet they are now inviting others to come in and prey on us, and that's what I believe it is.
Ah,
you know.
Exactly, yeah, right.
And I don't mean
free trade means unfair trade, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, free trade, someone, and when government uses free trade or privatization, then I think about, well, what's next? I'll be only allowed to come out at certain times that the government and the business want me to come out of my house or do what they think we should do. But anyway, that was it. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, aloha. Well, the discussion, and call if you got other comments, you can call back. As I say, I have no objection to APEC. I'm not a global person when it comes to economics. But what I can say is when you're sweeping people off the streets, the homeless, you're beautifying Nimitz Highway and... you know, you're putting up coconut trees, and coconut trees, they drop the leaves, and they then fall into the streets. And so that's just an indicator. And there's no area where these leaves would fall unless they're falling straight in the lanes in some of those instances. And it just tells you everything. It's depressing. You know, and on one hand, you think, well, we got leaders from around the world meeting, and they're not talking about fighting and shooting one another. That's a good thing. But on the other hand, we all become slaves to the system, and that's what it is becoming. But Again, back to what I wanted to share with you today is that now I have repeatedly listed a number of things where Hanneman is just flat out. The fundraiser in Pittsburgh was a fundraiser, an illegal fundraiser. The entire system, the enforcement part of this, allowed him to skate free. This man is able to, and a lot of you were upset about Ra Tam. I hear you talking, well, he only got 2 days in jail. Let me suggest this. If you have no problem with reading the newspaper that Mufi Hanneman is stepping back into the race, and you have no problem with that, then you should let Ra Tam ripen on the vine and just go away. But I got a little tidbit for you. For some reason, this power structure that will allow Jeremy Harris to walk away, and then you see his beautiful home being sold, and we've got questions where he got his house from, nobody's upset about that. Nobody's pissed off about that. Everybody's just talking and Ra Tam. I mean, Ra Tam, if he violates the law and our trust, he should go to jail or pay dearly. But it raises the curiosity, it heightens it. When, now, you may not know this, but Chuck Tato is attempting to prosecute Ra Tam a second time. Now, yeah, he did wrong, but I have to ask, how is it that Mufi Hanneman can give monies to his friends, have illegal campaigns, and all of that? And by the way, I'm still waiting for Chuck Tato to actually come forward with an investigation where I gave him taped conversations of secretaries advising and informing me and admitting that Hanneman used them in his campaign illegally. Chuck Tato is struggling to get through that, because he wants to cover up for Hanneman. And this is what the system, we talk about the apex. Well, let's look at the apex. These are critters that are feeding on us from top down. From the Abercrombies, the Inouyes, the Akakas, the Hiranos, the Hanabusas, the whole batch of them. And then they're telling you, and I'm getting these stupid emails, oh, you have a chance to help us stay in power, Carol. No, I wish I have the ability to help you get out of power, because you are doing us wrong. You're not doing what is right and democratically proper. You're wrong, folks. And when we're taking one man and chasing him, and you're using him to hang him on the fence to say in a pitiful way that you're doing something to uphold the law by prosecuting and persecuting Ra Tam. Yet, I've brought you Patty Teruya. And you're struggling through the Ethics Commission, and she indicates in emails that if she goes down, she'll take down everyone else, to include Mufi Hanneman and David Tenoy. Where is that pursuit? So, again, when you take this kind of climate and this environment where they're willing to take, and by golly, I'm going to try and get to Ra Tam on the show, and I'm not defending Ra Tam. I don't go away taking it the wrong way. But what I'm saying as a measure of a means of gauging just how criminal and corrupt your political system here is now, it is, you might want to ask the APEC people that are here to send troops to help us get our country back, because you have no control in this state. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. You have attacks on the police department where a few of them charges over time, and there's questions about their filings and the statements given. But the mayor himself isn't held accountable for the millions that he give out. Millions. Taxpayers' dollars. So when a system turns on itself and starts to prosecute and persecute and chase the officers of enforcement, and yet the lawmakers get to decide, well, what are you going to do tomorrow, Hanneman? Oh, you know, I'm thinking maybe, you know, I might run for governor. Oh, come on, Murphy, tell us. You can tell us what your plans are. You know, and then we're suckers. We sit around and we accept this nonsense, and we're a democracy. And we send our troops off to go and build and enforce and try and build a system that is democratic on the other side of the oceans. And yet we can't have the guts to stand up and tell a guy like this, well, you know what, you ran for mayor and you got in lucky. The stars fell in place for you, because if we had been using our brains, we would have sent you to jail. But instead, we gave you mayorship, and then we sit and decide that you can become governor at your own terms and at your own pace. And then we turn and we say to Neil Abercrombie, oh, yeah, you know, you can give up that seat, and it's just going to cost us $1 million for you to run and screw us some more as governor. And then we look and we're angry that Rod Tam only gets 2 days in jail. What kind of mental problems are we experiencing here, folks? Something's wrong. We whine like dogs when they hear the sirens go, but we never go to see and take an action. So it's not them now, I'm learning. When I go into Calvin Say's office, and it's supposed to be a meeting for whatever reasons, I don't know what it would have been, but he was smelling his vinegar, I guess, and he wanted to convey to me that nothing's going to change. And yet, all the while, I'm pointing out to him, this is corruption. This is nepotism. He has no problem with that. And the reason he has no problems with that is that he will be voted in again, because we find greater pleasure in seeing and taking issue with a man getting 2 days in jail for stealing from us, but the guy that steals a bigger bag of the money and stay in power, you don't have an issue with that. And now, backing to Murphy Hanneman, you figure this out. And then in the next hour, we're going to be talking about schizophrenia. And I didn't purposely plan this, but I'm trying to drive home a point to share with all of you. I care about all of you as well as I care for myself. But someone needs to put something in our water to make us smarter, make us stronger, make us start to think, get rid of the apathy. Because right now, folks, Murphy Hanneman in the climate point, he can lose because we sent him a message. No, we don't want you, and we don't want your bag of tricks. Go away. And then we wake up and we pay for a newspaper that tells us, oh, he has a chance. Well, wait now. Let's figure out, let's work this way backwards. So Turtle Bay seemed to have gotten what they want. They were big development and big hotels, and a number of other companies that run hotels got to do what they want to do and build and what have you. And pops the weasel. When Hanneman loses his butt in the race, he goes and gets a job as a CREO, the Creole for the hotels. And not a single person complain, not a single person say that the courts are corrupt, not a single person say anything. But here's this little guy, Rod Tam, and I'm just using Rod Tam just to bring your attention. You know, I want to try and use this as to, so you can measure up and compare just how difficult it is, if from my stance, to understand this, where while we are putting so much emphasis on wrongdoing, but the wrongdoing that should be, people should be put in jail, and I mean for a long time, they get to come back and decide, well, I think I'll run for Congress. Well, the paper tells us, well, Murphy is probably one of the better ones. Because Gabbard, you know, she's new to this process. And Kaina, she is, well, you know, she has some administrative background. But the problem is, we haven't found anything that they've done illegal. We haven't seen them give millions of dollars to their friends. You see, that's what the difference is. And then we're going to go and vote for Mufi Hammond. Oh, he has a big war chest. He got a lot of money. He got big friends. The union just won. So what? You know, Al Capone kept the seamstress and the tailors in business wearing those fancy suits, but he still got his money illegally. So when we circle our friends and what have you, and we look at this, and when we see the Ethics Commission, the city ethics, play the games, and I'm still waiting. For example, I'm told through sources that Toto has interviewed some of these people that I filed a complaint where Hanneman was using the secretaries. And guess what? That was a while back. Why foot drag? Because he don't want to burden Hanneman with the ethics issues. What about Todd Oppo? What about Charles DeJoux? They had problems. Why didn't they go to jail? Andrew Jamila, $500 for, but on the other hand, having great conflicts of interest. Where is the concern? Why aren't we demanding that they go to jail? Why they don't get any day in jail? So why don't we ask those questions?
Good morning, caller.
Come in a question.
Yeah, Carol. You know, another thing is this local media that we got here. You know, the paper and the television. Where are they? They just pick whoever they want, and they don't really pick the really bad guys.
Yeah. Well, have you ever gotten a call from the newspaper to ask them what your opinion is? If you look at the commentaries, the political, whether it's 1959, I'm exaggerating now, but you get the same political people having comment.
Right.
They don't want to know what you think.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to know what you feel. They just serve it up and tell you, well, you know, and the Hanneman is this and that, and but on their staff, the newspaper staff, they have people that worked on Hanneman's campaign efforts,
right,
as governor. And so we're supposed to look at this and read it, and then when they throw us this thing about this little bone about Ra Tam,
mm-hmm,
oh, Ra Tam is evil. No, it's not Ra Tam being evil. I mean, he got 2 days in jail, and now they're trying to indict him again.
Right.
And yet, where's the handcuffs from Hanneman?
Uh-huh.
Right?
The Coonies.
And the rest of them.
Yeah.
Where's the handcuffs for them?
Yeah.
And why? Because the Peter Carlisle sits in the main seat, and he's the pilot of this jet, and he decides, well, he should have been doing the prosecution, but isn't it funny that he got in office and then we found that everything that he should have been investigating and prosecuting Hanneman on, he picked the ball up and further carried it further up the hill?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's amazing what he can do and whatnot.
Yeah, and he can only do that is because we are focused on the wrong things. We are pissed off that Ra Tam gets 2 days in jail. Isn't that, you know, what is it? Is it in our water or what?
Yeah, it's unreal.
Yeah. So hopefully, I don't say this just to be venting. I'm saying this is that my observation is that, folks, we're in trouble. And if we are a free nation, the only thing that we can be reminded of as being free is our previous efforts and fighting wars to free other people.
Yeah.
But we're not free ourselves anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're not. I'm sorry. You have no control over your taxes. You have no control over your utilities. You have no control over your waters.
Right.
You have no control over anything. You don't even have control over the freeways.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they call them freeways, but now they're closed ways. But, you know, but anyway.
And Carol, can I ask you something off the subject?
Yeah.
Concerning the Marine Corps base, you know, with the helicopter incident.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything else followed up with that?
I'm waiting now for my FOIA documents. I've been a little late, and they wanted to have 20 days, and I got distracted with other things, and I should have them this week, and we'll see. But no, didn't hear from any state legislators, didn't hear from the city
yeah.
or anything. They're not interested.
Well, I heard the base commander, Colonel Woods, was relieved of his command over there.
Yeah, they were. But how can we take that same effort and get some of these politicians relieved of their... Is it contagious? I wished it was. I hope that people realize that they're better off. And I mean, this is to just vote everybody out and bring in no-namers.
Yeah.
At least we can look at the no-namers and tell, look in their eyes because they're fresh. We can tell if they're lying to us.
Yeah.
You know. But these other guys, man, they're wearing fake eyelashes and lenses and glasses and shades and speaking through public relations people.
Right. Media people that they hired, you know.
Yeah, media people.
Yeah.
There's no accident that everybody you turn, you look and say, oh, well, what happened to that news reporter? Oh, he's now working for, you know. What happened to John Yoshimura?
Yeah.
Well, you know, went in his drunkard state and run off. Oh, a cocker picked him up, and he's now at Washington, D.C., running office up there. Oh, I see. You know. It's something's wrong here, man, and they don't purposely put these people in place.
Yeah.
So if they show up to do an interview, they're not going to ask the hard-hitting questions because somewhere down the line, and I've said this before,
right.
they're going to have a job in mind because as they get older, they want the youth to be on TV and pretty hands, pretty hair, and what have you, right?
Right.
You're one wrinkle away from working for the state
uh-huh.
if you're a reporter in this town.
Well, you know, back then in the council, we got Murakatani and Macho and all that. We got them, but
yeah.
ever since then, there's nobody going after anybody. Only poor Rotan.
Yeah. Oh, man. Wow. You know, for me, I think everybody should go to jail when they violate public
right.
trust. But at some point, I mean, come on. but this is our culture. We, you know, we get great pleasure in telling the government why we didn't nail the other guy to the wall, crucify the other guy who did little.
Yeah.
And then we cheer on the other guy. Oh, that's Mufi. You know, I got a picture with Mufi the other day. Yeah, well, put some stripes on him and put some bars in front of his face. That would be the best picture I would like to see because you know why?
Yeah.
There are senior citizens that I know that can't afford to even cut their pills up now.
Uh-huh.
They can't even afford to buy them because they got to pay for the water. They got to pay for the sewage. They got to pay higher rates for the cars.
Property tax.
Property taxes.
Yeah.
You see, in the old days, they say, well, I just cut my medicine in half and then I can get by.
Uh-huh.
Well, you can't even buy it now.
Yeah.
You follow.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you look at the homeless and you're shepherding them around and you move them over here and you move them over there. Oh, no, this has nothing to do with APEC. No, you're right. All righty.
Yeah, okay, Carol.
Thank you. Anyway, folks, I don't want to pretend that I'm always happy, and I am human, and this is why I put this effort to say that we need to do something. And if you think you're comfortable today, just remember, you're one more political decision away from failure. And when Mizuno, Calvin Say, and others can look you straight in the eye and say, well, I don't see a problem with a man having his wife working in government and making decisions for us all. I have no problem with that. Something's wrong there. Well, the Senate has it. Well, this is basically a quote from Calvin Say, and I want you all to go away knowing that while it was puzzling, it was entertaining. I said, and this is supposed to be a meeting, I'm assuming, one-on-one, but I get there's two other guys with Say. Well, maybe it's that factor that we're violent. I don't know what it is, but nevertheless, I was there in the meeting, and he tells me that he's not going to change it. And in the process, He has no problem with any of this. He was bragging about it. Wasn't going to change anything. And he said to me, well, I think why the Senate has a law changed and prohibits the senators having their wives working for them and defining nepotism and prohibiting nepotism is that they wanted to make me look bad. That's why they passed that law. So I'm wondering, did the United States Senate and the United States Congress also do this to make him look bad? This is what happens when you get little people who have absolutely nothing in life but themselves and their ego, and when you allow them to get in office and they sit there and their heads swell, well, their brains don't, but their heads get bigger. You go over there to Calvin Say's office and you can see they've modified the door, folks, so that he can get his head and ego in. To tell me that the Senate only authored the bill and passed the bill and put the language in there was to make him look bad because he allows the House legislators to hire their wives. Nothing to do with, hey, maybe it's to keep people honest and maybe it's for the betterment of the taxpayers. Maybe it's the respect to come up with good government. Maybe none of that. It was to make him look bad. Now, in order to make him look bad and to follow through with that, I would have to participate and be privy to this thing to raise this issue that the Senate made nepotism illegal or prohibiting it because they wanted to make Calvin Say look bad. You figure that one out. And when you do, then I think you'll know who not to vote for. You don't have to call me up and tell me, aha, I got it. Just do the right thing and send this man a love letter and tell him we're in love with him, but we would be more appreciative if he would just vacate the premises. Because guess what? If your government, the chairman or the speaker of the legislative, the House, is compromised, as you heard me say, he filed his amendments late, things that he should have disclosed a couple of years ago. And then before I filed a complaint where he, with his company, didn't indicate that he was secretary of the Warabay or whatever the name it is with the sushi. And then he has no problem with Joey Manahan, his vice speaker of the House. See, these aren't the lower levels people. This is the vice speaker of the House, Joey Manahan. His wife is Marianne. I tried to talk to him. He didn't have time to talk to me. He had her to call me back. John Mizuno, great effort on the social issues. But John, I got to tell you, brother, you can't be out there serving up good things and then you're compromised. You can't do that. Good government is good government from the surface to the core. And so, having said all of that, I wanted to bring your attention on a complaint that I received from city employees. And I want you to follow this one, and it's massive. And it was sent out, it was to me, and I'll just basically tell you, this is unusual. It's on a city letterhead, and it's to Carol Cox, from employees of the Emergency Services Department. Subject, overtime abuse and improper city administrative conduct. Mr. Cox, enclosed you will find a copy of documentation that was sent to State Auditor Marion Higa, Hawaii State Ethics Commission Chairperson Maria Sullivan, Hawaii State Ethics Commission Executive Director Les Kondo, Hawaii State Department of Health Director Loretta Fuddy, and Deputy Director Keith Yamamoto. Now, I'm going to post this up at carolcox.com, carolcox.com, and I want you to see, while they're busy with APEC, and now this was sent to me on dated October 10th, 2011, but I just received it in this month. They sent one to Higa in July 30th, 2011. And you just got to see this. If you see these things, and if you understood what was going on in the EMS, you would prefer having a taxi cab come to pick you up. Because there is no way that you can beat down employees in any circumstance and get the best of them and have them working freely and willingly and without threat of firing or punishment and, you know, and being harassed. You wouldn't want that at the box factory where they make cardboard box. You want productivity and you want things to flow. How about if you had a climate where people were afraid, and they're the ones who get in the ambulance and drive to the emergency scene of a car accident or a trauma victim, but they're worried because there's corruption, there's overtime and favoritisms and harassments and all of that, and you file complaints, and your boss is found to go out and respond to accidents that he is not trained to respond to. The director of this facility, of this thing, is Dr. Jim or James Ireland. Now, there's a great many complaints involved in this complaint. So I didn't have time, and when you're working with the city and the state people and whatever, any time I knock on the door, they ask, well, do you have flowers? And, well, no, I don't have any flowers. Uh-oh, well, we better be careful. What do you want? You know, and it's almost like that. So in this case, I've called around to the state and the city, and I asked for the fiscal year 2010. While I can't sort through all of these complaints in a hurry, I took one. And one specific allegation, and I want you to listen up, and this allegation that's being made is Dr. Ireland, the director of the EMS division, has or had an older model ambulance that he collects. And it was in disrepair to some degree. It needed new tires, a new carburetor, and some other works. And he wanted to drive it in the City Lights parade. So, how does he handle that? Part of this complaint is that Dr. Ireland had said that they use city money and overtime to build it and repair it and what have you, and use the city mechanics. Well, and they use city money. Now, I called the city and asked for the fiscal year 2010 accounting records, and they promised to send them to me, and to date I have not received them. But we're going to move on anyway with this. So what I did, and it said that Dr. Ireland in this complaint, while on occasion he works at the office, he's also running a medical business or practice there at Wahiwa Medical Center. Well, I went over to Wahiwa yesterday to confirm, and yes, there's Dr. Ireland's name on the board. So that's part of the complaint, and I don't know how the conflict, we haven't gotten that far yet, but back to this vehicle. So the complaint is that city money and city personnel and city facility was used to fix this car. What I did do, I spoke to the mechanic that performed this work, and he confirmed that, yes, he did purchase tires for the doctor's personal car to go in the parade, and the mechanic used his personal MasterCard charge card to buy the tires. He paid a total of $542.53. And then he informed me that the doctor reimbursed him with cash. Well, there's several things that goes on wrong with that. If you are the director, you shouldn't be using lower-ranking subordinates to go and purchase anything from you, because they will feel obligated that they must make you a loan. Or if you don't do it for him, then he will take action against you. Or if I do it for him, he'll allow me to do things that are unethical and illegal. Good morning, caller. Comment or question?
Hello?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Who's this?
The Carol Cox Show.
Hey, Cox, I want you to know I consider you one of Hawaii's treasures, okay? Let's start with that.
Okay.
And I want you to know that I think I as people there know my bullfrog voice. I've been on this rig and making an ass of myself for a long time. And I want you to know what we figure out is causing all this problem in our country here. And it's our corrupt monetary system. And it's a gimmick that is used. And there's a gimmick used to steal the wealth of our country, mainly from the middle class and the poor, which the money elite are trying to destroy. They don't want the middle class and the poor, who incidentally is the foundation of this country, for the simple reason that all the money that we use in circulation comes when people make loans. People who understand the money system knows that when we make loans, the money that, say you make a mortgage, that mortgage money goes into circulation. And it goes round and round, and it ends up with the big boys having it, and the poor middle class and the poor bankrupt. That's the system. And how does that system work? The gimmick used is very simple. It's mathematically impossible and physically impossible to repay the aggregate debt for the simple reason. The reason is very, very important to check. The only money... the only money created is for the principal. When you borrow your money, no money is created for the interest. That is a system, people, and that is a gimmick, and that's why we are all dumbed down 100% by the Council on Foreign Relations. Every dean of the universities are all CFR members to dumb us all down. And if you want further proof of that, get the Hidden Agenda by Norman Dodge, who know a little papaya head. He was the chief investigator in 1950 for un-American activities and stuff. He's the guy that got the minutes of the meetings of the big boys, J.P. Morgan and all that. And so he knows he knows their agenda from way back from 1915.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get the Hidden Agenda, the book and the video, it'll tell you all. Norman Dodds made this video. He died a month later. And this video is equivalent to Martin Luther. Not Martin Luther. Luther, you know what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
I had a dream.
Mm-hmm.
That great speech, one of the greatest speeches in history.
Mm-hmm.
This one, if you Hidden Agenda here, is I think is a very, very great thing too, and people should all know about it.
Right.
But anyway, that's how the wealth of our country is scooped by this system. Very simple. They lower the interest rates, so everybody gets their big mortgages,
right.
which they cannot pay. The rich can pay it, no problem. They make all the money, but the poor middle class cannot.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up, that's how they scoop all the wealth. Everybody goes bankrupt and all that. They scoop the wealth of the country. And that's what we have today, and that's what's causing all this problem, what we have now in our economy. You never hear anybody talk about it except Ron Paul over there. Ron Paul, he's a man. He's the only honest guy,
yeah,
if you ask me, that's worth his salt, yeah, running for office there.
Well,
and
okay.
We know about Ron Paul from way back.
Right. Well, thank you. I'm going to have to...
Hey, one more thing I wanted to before I close up.
Okay.
There is a book called the... now, this is very vital, too. Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster by David Icke. David Icke is one of the boys that you folks should be familiar with. And in it, one of our...
praises the sweetest God, the best, the greatest leader in the whole way or whatever, has a quote in there. Now, you get this book and you check the quote. Don't have to listen to this damn fool over here.
Okay.
No, wait, what was it? Here's the quote. There exists a shadow government with our own Air Force, its own Navy, its own fundraising mechanism, and the ability to pursue its own ideas and a national, off the national interest, free from all checks and balances and free from the laws. This is from our number one leader or whatever. Go check this out and you'll get informed like you never did in probably your whole damn life.
All righty.
Thank you, sir. And hey, you are a treasure in this town as far as I'm concerned, okay?
Hey, thank you.
Keep it
so
up
much.
Now.
Aloha.
And
I like that. I mean, some of you probably know, where does that fit? Well, as I say, if you got something on your chest and you'd want to air it, call up, share it. Because you can't do it with the papers and you can't do it with the TV. So anytime, I can't digest it all in seconds, but it's out there now. So, and again, carolcox.com, CARROLLCOX.com. And if you have a question or comment, 524-1080. Now, backing to this this complaint, there's many issues here where, now, again, with this complaint, now, it was Mufi Hanneman who appointed Dr. Ireland. It was Mufi Hanneman who appointed Dr. Char. And if you remember some while back on the shows where I told you, Hanneman had requested that I participate in his team of selecting his directors and leaders in his administration, and I did. But what I didn't know, when we chose someone else, we were told, no, we can't hire that person because Hanneman Muthi has already picked Dr. Char and promised her the job. So you know that big thing that, this is how this guy operates. That big effort that he came out and he had Joel Pickard as one of the people and Mark Tilker, who's at BEI and has great contracts and great closeness to Hanneman. This is supposed to have been a great selection to get the best of the best. But he'd already promised so that he could get votes from the community in Chinatown. Well, this complaint talks about Dr. Char and Dr. Ireland being, if they do phase out this effort and go and merge with the fire department or whatever that process is, they're going to give these people, these two entities, individuals, a golden parachute and let them be part of this. Who's going to let that happen? Well, apparently, I called the city manager's desk and was supposed to get some answers back, and then they said we would, and then later, oh, you need to send everything in writing so we can be accurate. Well, the concern is simple. The complaint says that they are fixing it up. The City Emergency Medical Service Division is they're going to hire and a retain or something. I don't have the documents, and I'm going to surely be pursuing them, and that they're going to give, in the process of working for getting Dr. Ireland or Dr. the city is. And I don't know how Dr. Ireland plays into this. But anyway, this complaint, and I do apologize because, again, the city, whenever they see me or hear that I'm calling, they shut down and they stall. And so it's my policy, while others say fair and balanced, if I call you and ask you, I'm entitled to certain information, within I'm able to go in and view it by law in a reasonable time during the normal working hours, and you should share that with me. But instead, I'm required to put everything in writing and send it in and wait another week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or whenever. They may even ignore it. So my policy is, if you're going to resort to that tactic as an administrator or a bureaucrat, then I'm going to employ my tactics, and that is, I'm going to go with what I have in hand, though they are allegations, and I'm going to go and try and prove or disprove and look in to see, trying to be fair, not balanced, because there's no such thing as being fair and balanced when you call up an administrator who you buy a cell phone for with taxpayers' money, and then they tell you he's not available. He'll have to get back to you next week. Well, then that's why you delegate information or authority to others. The government keeps rolling, not because you go on a vacation or some boondoggle or, you know, or some trip. So that's what the problem is. And again, this is going to be posted up on carolcox.com, the full complaint. And it was sent to also Mr. Peter Carlisle. It is, some of the complaints speaks about Carrie Okinaga, who's now, Hanneman handpicked her, or Carlisle handpicked her, and she's now at Hart. And there's a lot of things in here, folks, that you should really be concerned with, because now when you see the ambulance, I guarantee you, if you read this complaint, you will think different about the ambulance service and the integrity of it and the people. The people that work there should be free of harassment, free of this kind of stuff. So obviously there's some problems going on with this. And even from the higher ranks, I'm still investigating a matter where Patty Dukes was put on temporary duty or assignment or whatever because of an incident involving the use of morphine on one of the city workers. I don't have all the details, and I'm still looking. But you will think differently of the city's emergency services when you see an ambulance, when you look at these complaints, and when you know that nothing has been done and Carlisle has received the same complaint and did absolutely nothing. And just go to that website and you will see what is happening here. Part of the allegations is that he's also, Dr. Ireland, is farming out some of the work to his former employer, AMR, American Medical Response. So anyway, please join me in the next hour. I hope that I didn't scare half of you away and with such militant thinking and what have you. But, you know, enough is enough. Let's call it what it is. If a man gets 2 days in jail and we raise holy hell, but a guy can screw us out of millions, hundreds of millions, and give to his friends, and all the thing that we are sitting here scratching our head is that, who do we vote for next? You know, we just don't have a whole... Yeah, you have a choice. I'm not saying vote for Gabbard. I'm saying vote anybody. Vote for Goofy instead of Moofy. That's the logo. Okay? I'll see you in the next hour, and we're going to be talking schizophrenic and schizophrenia and how to sell your books or print on online electronically. So please join me. Terry Morgan is going to be joining me. Aloha.
Half of the Carol Cox Show, right after the news on KWAI Honolulu, K108.
You
Okay. Good morning again, and welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. Second half. All excited. And last week we talked about autism and with Dr. Boldman and Jessica Wong. And have an interesting, as a continuation of that of sort, we're going to be talking about schizophrenia, but it's in a different form. There's an author here that I'm lucky or fortunate enough to have met, and her name is Terry Morgan, and she's going to share with us of her book, and it is Playing Genetic Lottery.
Oh, Playing the Genetic Lottery.
Playing the Genetic Lottery. And it's interesting. And Terry, thank you for joining me. And,
my pleasure. Meeting you the other week was just one of the highlights of my visit home.
Yeah, don't tell them that. Now, they'll all be standing outside waiting to meet me.
Yeah.
But you live in Santa Cruz.
Right. I partially grew up here. I moved here in January of 1970 when I was a freshman in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Graduated from Radford High School, which I'm mm-hmm. very proud of. And then a year later, I moved to the mainland to go to college and ended up sticking around. Now I live in Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
And I come home frequently. My father's passed away a couple years ago, but my mom still lives here.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of considered myself somewhat of a local. I mean, I get here and the pigeon comes back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything sort of comes back. But, I guess I am a Californian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're playing the genetic lottery, and you're going to talk about the book, and it's about raised with two parents that are schizophrenic?
Yeah, it's a fictional memoir of a 32-year-old woman who grew up with two schizophrenic parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of looks at everything, nature versus nurture, the genetic component, and then, you know, nurturing, what happens to kids that grew up in that kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of research for it. I'm really fascinated by human behavior mm-hmm. and what makes people tick and mental illness and things like that. So I learned a lot about it, but I tried to write it in a novel format so it would reveal the information rather than tell.
So you're going to also share with us that you just published, and you're going to share with us how one can publishing something on electronically.
Right, yeah.
And the benefits of it.
Yeah, I published it. It just came out hot off the computer on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And I published it as an ebook for a couple reasons. One, ebooks for people that aren't familiar, Kindles, Nooks, iPads like yours,
mm-hmm.
Things that you can read electronically, and they're great. I was one of the last holdouts who said, I love books, I'll never give them up. And I heard from my friends how much they love their Kindles. I've got one, you can't pry it out of my hands. And they're great. You can download books almost instantly, and you can download a whole bunch. So if you're traveling a lot, read them on the plane. You don't have to bring a stack of books.
Mm-hmm.
Just bring one little, small, thin e-reader. Anyway, I e-published it for a couple of reasons. One is it's inexpensive. It's actually, you know, very, very cheap for me to e-publish. Two is that's sort of the trend now. If you notice, the New York Times now does it on their bestseller list. They do e-books, list the e-books. And e-books is a growing industry. It seems to increase something like 20% every year. And I hope it doesn't completely eliminate books, because I love books. But it's a great way for people to get started, and it's a great way to get information out inexpensively and in an environmental manner.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, you're transmitting digital information over the Internet or through the wireless, and you're not using paper, you're not using cardboard, you're not shipping books, which, you know, uses up a lot of fuel and energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very ecological way to go.
So anyway, we'll talk about that later, but I'm really interested, I'm sure they are too, about the book and its contents. And you have a foreword, or?
I have the introduction. I thought that this is a really good way to introduce the book. That's why I put it in the book, as the introduction. And it sort of sets the tone. So I'm going to read it to you.
Yeah.
Story out. Okay, the introduction to Playing the Genetic Lottery. Every morning when I first wake up, I wonder and I worry. Before getting out of bed, before registering my full, aching bladder, before remembering what day it is and what responsibilities await, I assess myself for the signs of the disease. I roll around the room, looking for phantoms that may have appeared while I was sleeping, for odd, moving sights, like my dresser transformed into a rolling automobile or a roaring lion. to make sure the clock radio on my nightstand or the framed photos on the bookshelves haven't cloned themselves overnight and morphed into twins or even triplets. Then I listen carefully. I hear Jason snoring lightly beside me. I hear the ticking of the living room clock. I hear the jangle of Roscoe's tags as he rolls over on the bed in the corner of our room. I hold my breath and listen for mysterious voices or alien noises. Then, once I'm sure I'm not hearing any unusual, strange sounds, I ask myself, silently so not to wake my sleeping husband, a series of questions. Who am I? What's my address? Where do I work? How old are my children? What's my husband's name? Who's the president? Only after the correct responses to the first five pop into my mind, and I chuckle to myself after answering Calvin Coolidge to the sixth question, because I know good and well that Barack Obama currently resides in the White House, do I know I'm safe for another day? If I still have my sense of humor, and apparently my faculties, I've still escaped it. Escaped the mental illness that afflicted and consumed my mother, my father, and my brother. Escaped the schizophrenia that robbed them of their minds and me of a childhood. I know that at 32, my chances of developing schizophrenia are minuscule and keep shrinking with every passing month. Despite that, I'm still obsessively terrified of developing the devastating mental illness that was an ever-present part of my formative years. It shaped who I've become, and I've worked for more than half my life to recover from its impact. My father, mother, and brother all lost the genetic lottery, and their misfortune continues to ripple through my life even today. My name, at least the name I go by now, is Caitlin. That's the name I chose for myself 18 years ago when I fled my childhood home of horrors. I cast off the name on my birth certificate for a new one in hopes of casting off the madness that was my family. And that's the introduction, and I think it really sets the tone. Introduces Caitlin, the main character, the protagonist, and it talks a little bit about schizophrenia and the different forms it takes. And it is truly a devastating mental illness.
And what is it for some listeners out there? Well, describe it in a layman's term.
Sure. It's the most devastating of all the mental illnesses, and there's a lot of misconceptions out there. It's not split personality like most people think, and schizophrenics aren't like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, where they turn completely, change their personalities when they have an episode, and they're not all geniuses like John Nash in the movie, The Mathematician. But there's several different forms of schizophrenia, and the scientists don't know exactly what causes it. They think it's some kind of chemical difference in the brain, and they know that there is a genetic tie. But it causes all sorts of short circuits in the brain, and some people hear voices that they can't shut off. Can you imagine having a radio station where their dial's being constantly turned? It plugged in your ears 24 hours a day? Some people have it feel like that. Some people have visions. They'll see things like you turning into three Carol Coxes. Some people hear things that aren't there. It's just devastating. It's really hard for schizophrenics to separate reality from the disease.
Now, the character that you write about, the 32-year-old lady,
right.
This is taken from a real person.
No, this
or is it?
This is entirely a work of fiction.
Completely, where you didn't interview someone and then...
No, I didn't interview someone, but I did do a tremendous amount of research. I've been a journalist since 1980, and I love to research. I love to learn. So I read everything I could get my hands on. I went on the Internet, scoured all the websites. And I have some friends who have schizophrenic relatives, and I had a lot of conversations with them about, their relative and when the disease developed, how it manifested itself, what, the whole nine yards, how their son or daughter or brother or sister is being treated, how they're doing now, and then how it affected the families.
So a lot of time and effort went into the research, because if you're writing fictitiously, you want to be accurate, because this is a very sensitive subject, I suspect.
Exactly. It's a very sensitive subject, and I wanted to be accurate, and I wanted to be... fair isn't the right word, but I wanted to be sensitive to people who have schizophrenia and to people whose family members have schizophrenia, because what I picked up from interviewing people who had schizophrenic relatives was, my brother has schizophrenia, He lives in a group home. He's never going to be a protective member of society, but I love him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, he's difficult. Yeah, sometimes I do screen his calls because he can, you know, tend to go on, and it's hard to get him off the phone. He'll do, you know, looping and just keep mm-hmm. talking about the same thing and other. But he's my brother. I love him. You know, I do what I can to take care of him. Mm-hmm. That's what I got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the interviews more than the, you know, the reading research.
And this research took you, so the listeners, they probably have similar subjects or would want to write about something. Where did some of these efforts find you? You found yourself in libraries and what other doctors or did you interview?
No, I didn't interview doctors, but I did go to the library and I bought some books on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
And about schizophrenia, and some were written by psychiatrists who became psychiatrists solely because they had a sibling who was schizophrenic. So there's a lot of interest, and there are a lot of people that have family members that are schizophrenic. One interesting thing I learned in my research, which really shocked and surprised me, is one out of every 100 to 120 people born develop schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's universal in the United States, China, India, all across the world. And it's a pretty high percentage. So it's pretty hard to find somebody who hasn't been touched with schizophrenia in their family or close friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that, you know, I really wanted to make sure to get things accurate. But Caitlin is fictitious.
Right.
Her experience is fictitious, but I sort of tried to base it on realistic scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, took creative license.
Right, and I see you, this is Ava.
Yeah, that was her original name.
Her original name is Ava, but Caitlin now, and you talked about that, and how the mom decided to name her.
The mom decided to name her children after characters in Gene Owl's Children of the Earth novels.
Right, the cave people.
The cave people. They're great books. I remember reading the first one. I literally could not put it down.
Mm-hmm.
So she names her oldest son, John Dillar, and she names her daughter, Isla. And Isla ends up being called Ava because her brother's 3 years old when she's born, and he can't pronounce Isla.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets off pretty easy and doesn't get teased as much at school. But for John Dillar, having a nickname like, or a full name like that, boy, you know how mean kids can be.
So this family suffering or experiencing this quite would be somewhat dysfunctional, difficult, would it be?
Extremely difficult. I mean, it's like, I don't even think a roller coaster is the right word. It might be like being on a tilt-a-whirl while there's an earthquake going on constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And you never know what the schizophrenic people are going to do, how they're going to act. The kids end up basically, especially the older brother, has to take on the adult role because the parents are incapable. And in my novel, they have extended family around, and the grandparents try to do what they can, and
mm-hmm.
they try to actually get custody of the kids. And the parents love their kids dearly, and
mm-hmm.
No way, you know, they're staying with us.
Now, the title of the book is Playing the Genetic
Lottery.
Lottery. So how does that, let's talk about the genetic lottery and how does this play into the book?
Well, it's an interesting question. That's one thing that researchers know. They've spent billions of dollars trying to uncover the causes of schizophrenia, find effective treatments. And the one thing they know about the causes is there is a genetic component.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have, say, if your mother or father is schizophrenic, you have a 25% chance of becoming schizophrenic yourself. If both your parents are schizophrenic, you have a 50% chance of becoming schizophrenic. If you have both parents are schizophrenic and you have a sibling, it goes up to about 62%. So having children, if you have this gene in your family, is you're really playing the lottery. You got your fingers crossed. Am I going to have a healthy child? Am I going to pass this devastating, debilitating mental illness onto my kids? A lot of people who have schizophrenia don't want to have kids, or you don't have schizophrenic relatives, because
mm-hmm.
they see firsthand how devastating it is, both for their schizophrenic relatives and for the family members that love them. I won't give it away, but Caitlin ultimately does have some children, and I won't explain how or why,
right.
because I want you to buy the book and find out for yourself. But that's what it is. It's when she has kids, that's what she considers. We're playing the genetic lottery.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. And it freaks her out.
Wow. And in your book, you talk about, you give one instance where she wakes up in the morning and a routine. Who am I? What is my address? Where do I work?
She's obsessively terrified, and this was something I found in my research, was a vast majority of people who grew up with schizophrenics and understand that there's a genetic component are completely terrified that they're going to develop it themselves. Even to the extent where Caitlin knows she's sort of past the age where she probably will develop it. In men, it starts manifesting itself in the late teens through early 20s generally, though there are some exceptions. And in women, it usually manifests themselves in the early 20s to early 30s. So 32, she's pretty much past the danger zone, but it's such a huge concern, it's been such a huge concern all her adult life, that she's still terrified. She can't shake it. You know, she's a bright young woman, she's got a sense of humor, she's got a loving family, she's pretty intelligent, she's really made a good life for herself, but she just can't escape this fear. And that's pretty common in you know, people who've been in horrible situations, not just raised by schizophrenic parents.
Yeah, and Caitlin is describing how she...
how she checks herself for symptoms every morning.
And then also you talk about one instance where she cried. Her brother said that she cried so often because mom was in the hospital being diagnosed
with this. Yeah, both parents were in and out of the hospital, and that also is common with acute schizophrenics, where people will have severe episodes and be a danger to themselves and others and be hospitalized. They'll be required to take medication. The brain chemistry will sort of correct itself. They'll get well. They'll get released, and often they stop taking the medication. So Caitlin grew up with her parents, both of them, being hospitalized at different times. So it wasn't what we'd call a stable childhood.
And that is the roller coaster you were talking about, where one day the mom in the book is painting,
right, the mom
and carrying on a normal life, and then all of a sudden an abrupt cessation of this.
It's not so abrupt in a lot of people. It can start developing slowly. Like one of my friends, his brother Charles, is a schizophrenic. He has been since his teens. He's probably 57 or 58 now. And he's in a group home, and he gets antipsychotic shots. And my friend can tell when his brother got the shot by his handwriting or by his phone calls, the way he's talking. And then he can tell when the medication's starting to wear off. He can tell when he's a day or two before he's going to get his next one. And then he can tell when he just got another shot, because his moods change, his ability to communicate changes, his handwriting changes. He'll go from writing a letter that, you know, you wouldn't suspect he's schizophrenic to taking big sheets of butcher paper and writing big circular letters and all the way through it, and, you know, barely legible. You know, there's some extremes, but it doesn't usually happen overnight.
Yeah, here's a quote I'm borrowing when I read it the other day. Quote, "Thank God for your brother," end quote, mom would say throughout my childhood whenever she was healthy, coherent, and annoyed. Quote, "If I had had you first, you'd be an only child."
Right.
I heard that and read that, and I'm thinking, I got to ask her about that particular point. What the implications of what was going on?
Well, yeah, obviously, Caitlin developed some issues with her mother, because some people who are schizophrenic tend to get really self-centered. And Caitlin had colic. She had what I call the bad case of the nose. The terrible tooth started early. And she was a difficult child, and the mom didn't have the patience, you know, being sick half the time. So her brother was the one that would calm her down and, you know, interpret. She needs her diaper changed, you know. She wants the bottle. She's tired. Things like that. But the mom was frustrated, and she let it rip. You know, where, say, I'm sure my mom was frustrated with me a lot, you know, when I was growing up, but for the most part, she held her peace, you know. But if you have a mental illness, even when you're coherent, you tend to have some personality flaws.
And reading what was provided, mom would tell stories.
Yeah.
And so how much of it would the child be able to discern that it was a figment of her imagination or an escapade or an event of, you know, what must have been
quite difficult in
real life?
Sure. It was quite difficult in the novel because kids are just making sense of the world. You know, I remember being about 5 or 6 and watching cartoons and going, oh, what's this? There's Yogi Berra and there's, you know, Yogi Bear, and how do they relate? And
right.
Then my mom's telling me this and TV's telling me that, and I read Superman comic books, and, you know, you're all confused. So imagine that, and then you've got a mother who's not consistent.
Mm-hmm.
It really throws you for a loop. You know, that first period where you're trying to make sense of the world is just getting more and more chaotic. So it's traumatic for kids.
And I didn't get all, well, obviously I hadn't read the book, but...
Well, it just came out Friday.
Yeah, but thinking of the grandparents, the aunts and uncles, did he have anybody in that family line or that had it? And
Not in the close family line. There's hints that a great uncle, somebody in that generation had it, and it was really unusual actually for the two schizophrenics to meet and marry. They didn't meet in a mental hospital. The father developed it as a teenager. The mother developed it, you know, in her early 20s. But for some reason they were drawn together and had kids, and it does happen. It's not as common as having a single parent schizophrenic.
Wow. It was, and they carried on. Dad worked at a hardware store, and in your story, they carry on normal lives and to some degree.
To some degree, in between episodes, and they had family in town, grandparents, that would encourage them, you know, to stay on their meds, go check on the kids constantly, especially when one or more was in the hospital. And, you know, they tried to take more control of the kids, but schizophrenic parents, just like parents everywhere, love their children, and you know, they don't want to let them go.
Yeah, that I was reading this, and I did not know that you were a graduate of Radford, and then I thought it sounded like there was a Hawaiian connection here, some of the local language in here.
Oh, perhaps. I didn't consciously put that in, but, you know, you spend your formative years in Hawaii, and pigeon's always going to be an integral part of your vocabulary. So probably some of the slang that I do in there, especially when Caitlin becomes a teenager and talks more like that, is probably probably somewhere in my subconscious.
Yeah. Are you going to visit Radford and share your book?
Well, I actually went there the other day to take some pictures of the school, and it's beautiful. I was telling, there was a, I don't know if he was a security guard or a parking guy, came up, and I was like, holy smokes, this does not look like the school I went to. And apparently they do cleanup days 3 times a year, and it had a fresh coat of paint. It just looked great. And I was kicking myself because I got cards that have a picture of the cover of the book and the website, terrymorgan.net, TerriMorgan.net, where you can find out more information from the book and actually read excerpts. And I was so excited about taking all these pictures that I forgot to give him a card and say, but I did introduce myself as a Radford alumni.
Yeah, and you also have radio experience.
Yeah, I've been a journalist for, well, like I said, since about 1980, and you know probably as well as I do the way the news industry has gone. You know, there's been a lot of papers closing and consolidating, the Honolulu paper being an example. So a lot of my work dried up, and I'd gotten laid off from the San Jose Mercury News, which was a great paper. I was a freelancer, but I got laid off, and there was an ad in the paper for a news reporter for a radio station in Santa Cruz, KSCO, which ironically is AM 1080. So I applied, and I got... That's a good spot on radio. So I applied and got the job, and, you know, got to learn radio broadcasting, which I'd already always been fascinated with, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but, yeah, someone asked me, how do you learn, where do you go to learn to do radio? Well,
you just do it.
You just do it, as long as, depending on what, if you want to entertain them, you entertain them. If you want to bring information and share it and be unbiased, you share that too. But
Yeah.
Well, I was lucky. I had some really great coworkers there. Rosemary Chalmers, who's sort of the program director. I call her the heart and soul of the station. She does the morning show along with Mother Vilt. She's the primary one, and she's an excellent interviewer. And I remember the first time when I had just gotten hired, I was so nervous, and they wanted to introduce me on the air, and we had swivel chairs, and I'm swiveling back and forth. And she starts talking and introduces me, and the next thing I know, we're just having this conversation. I felt like I was just talking to her on the phone as a close friend. She mm-hmm. got me completely calm. Then after that, I was over the hump, and she did that with just about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had some great mentors there, and so I learned pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a lot of it is just do it.
Now, you know, with the physical book,
right.
There's what you call a book signing or book signing tour. How do you replace that or get the same benefits? Is there some?
There is.
What's the strategy? I mean, it's all electronic. Do you have signings or?
Well, you don't quite have signings per se, though. Since ebooks are getting so much more popular, mm-hmm. now that the book is finally available, and by the way, the link to buying the book electronically is on my website,
mm-hmm.
terrymorgan.net. But I want to do two things. I've got a pretty detailed strategy. Now, once the book's out, I can actually start putting things in place. But because ebooks are getting so prominent, so accepted, my local bookstores carry them. And so mm-hmm. I'm going to talk to them about doing readings there. I'm going to send out press releases and offer to do readings. And I'm also going to go on what you call a virtual book tour.
Right.
Where you go to all the blogs and the websites for book lovers and book reviewers, and you set up a schedule just like you would a traditional book tour.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if they give you the okay, it's like, okay, every Monday morning I'll be on a different station. I'll either be interviewed or I'll write a blog. And that's how you do it.
So the social media is changing the world.
Tremendously.
The average person that has something to write about
can get
published now without having, and it's only, you can publish on demand, right?
You can publish.
That's the benefit of it?
You can publish on demand, and I'd like to do that as well because I have some friends that go, God, I'd love to read your book, but I don't have a Kindle. I don't even have a computer.
Right.
And it is kind of fun just to go in the bookstore. I've written books before, but they were all nonfiction. But it's really fun to go in the bookstore and see your book for sale on the shelf.
Right.
So I'm probably going to expand to that. But for right now, I'm sticking with the ebook.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a brave new world out there as far as publishing goes.
Well, you know, and I raise that question because there are a certain portion of the population that simply don't use
electronics.
So you wouldn't want to exclude
exactly.
them. So you would want somehow, do you have a physical mailing address that post office box where they can mail and get a hard copy upon?
Well, I don't have a hard copy
yet. I mean, when the need arises, if they make a request and you can buy one.
I'll have to set up a post office box
okay.
for that. Probably what I'm going to do with a print on demand is put them in my local bookstores,
mm-hmm.
put a link on my website, which wouldn't help people who don't have
right.
a site, and also put it for sale on Amazon.
Yeah.
But, that's a good point. I'll have to get so people can call me and order the book directly.
So I haven't given much thought until when you uttered the words electronic media and publishing, and I'm thinking, that's it. That's Kindle. iPads. And everybody's going to them, and they're buying them. What better way to write the book? Now, let me ask you this, then. You go through the same protocol, though. When you write the book, you get your editors.
Right.
And you get your, and then what's, walk me through that, or walk the listeners, because I'm sure there's someone out there have an interest in writing a book, wouldn't know where to get started. You mind sharing that?
No, not at all. Having a good editor is essential.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did when I was writing the book, I didn't tell very many people that I was writing a book because so many journalists go, oh, I'm going to write a novel. And, you know, they get through three chapters and then they get stalled. And I thought, well, you know, I've never written a novel before. Until I got this idea, I really had no interest in writing a novel, though I've been an avid fiction reader all my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept it pretty quiet, but I had a handful of friends, including friends who had schizophrenic relatives, and I would give them, I wrote the book in sections. I finished the first section, I'd pass it around, get input, and they correct typos and say, this doesn't ring true, or that's exactly how my brother acts. And after I put it, analyze all the input, and you take it some with a grain of salt. You got to consider who really knows, who doesn't, because you'll get conflicting advice from your editors. And then once I sort of rewrote stuff, made some changes, I hired a newspaper editor who I've worked with in the past. She's really good, and had her proofread it. At that point, I didn't really need an editor per se, because I've been writing for decades. And, I know how to write, and I like to think I'm a very good writer. And she went through it with a fine-tooth comb and corrected all the punctuation errors, all the formatting errors. And getting a good editor and or proofreader is essential if you want to have a professional product. And then the next step was formatting it. I published this on through an internet company called Smashwords, smashwords.com. And they and bookbaby.com are probably the two biggest publishers of ebooks. And to get it e-published, you have to get it formatted to fit their format. And I printed out the instructions. It was like 27 pages. Despite being on the cutting edge with ebooks, I'm not very computer literate. And I got about 3 pages into it and got completely tied up. So I hired somebody. I paid him $45. He formatted it beautifully. shipped it back to me. I finished, the last bit of requirements, uploaded it on Friday morning. And within an hour, I was on their website with a book for sale.
Wow.
So it's pretty exciting.
So there's a whole world out there waiting for new authors or authors that have been wanting to write but just didn't have the money or wouldn't catch the eye of the publishers or what have you.
Yeah, and the publishing industry has changed considerably. For example, I've written 4 nonfiction books and co-wrote 4 others through the 80s and the early 2000s. And I had an agent, and I wrote her a letter when I was about halfway through the novel and said, I'm doing my first fiction project. Would you be interested in, possibly representing me on that, even though she'd only represented me on nonfiction in the past? And she said, sure, and I shipped her the book. I don't think it was completely finished back then. And I got a reply from her a couple weeks later saying, gosh, this is a great book. I shared it with a lot of the agents in her office. She's got a huge agency in New York. We all really love it. It's obvious you've done a lot of research and are passionate about the subject. But, here's the but, there's always a but. The publishing industry has changed so much, and publishers are cutting back on books because it's become more of a business now, where they don't want to publish something just because it's a great book. They want to publish something because they know they can make money. And she says, with this current marketplace, I just don't think I'd be able to find you a publisher. So I was kind of disappointed and put the book aside for a while. And then a couple months later, I pulled it out and started rereading it. And I go, this is really good. I want to get this published. And I started looking at this print on demand. And I'm a researcher. I did all the research, and I found out e-publishing and how popular it's getting and how easy it's getting and how many people are turning to it. And just said, that's the route I want to go.
Wow. I was reading there in Chapter 3 in the excerpts that I was touched by something, and it brought me back to the reality of what goes on the streets here. There are people that are out there affected with this disease, and we're shuttling them around and being insensitive. And I thought, where do we learn that, to be so insensitive to the homeless and the ill, the suffering from this? And then I read this, you have this quote, John Dillard doesn't have a home, so he lives in a car. This was that chant that they walk away from school, they're walking, and they're now living in a trailer park.
Right.
And, and it's the chanting began behind us as John and I were walking home from our new school to our new home at the Golden Torch trailer park.
Right.
It was November, and we were the new kids in the respective classes. So then again, and he tells her, ignore it. But again, the treatment that we see that is projected on the adults on our streets and what have you, and then I look at this and I thought, wow.
Well, kids are cruel. I mean, we sort of romanticize childhood. Because I don't know about you, but I had a lot of fun as a kid. But there were bullies. There were kids that would talk, kids that were a little bit different. If they were overweight or they had too many freckles or they had a weird name or mm-hmm. they lived in a trailer park. And so that's typical kid behavior. It's not a lot of fun for the kid that's getting picked on.
Mm-hmm.
But with the adults, I think it's a fear-based thing. And as a reporter, I did cover quite a bit of crime stories where mm-hmm. I'd be in court waiting for, a trial to start. And they, if you've ever been in court, they have big dockets where they go through a whole bunch of names. And
right.
I started noticing that for the arraignments and things like that, about a third of the people were mentally ill. About a third were alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Another third had drug problems. And somewhere in there were just downright criminals. So I'm not very good at math, I got to admit.
Right.
But, and people were afraid of him. And, I covered stories about the homeless, and you'd go try to interview some people on the street, and some people would be completely drunk and couldn't talk. Some people would be obviously mentally ill. And I think it's a fear thing, because, you're mentally ill, you're living on the street, you're not worried about brushing your teeth, changing your clothes, taking a shower.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sometimes talking gibberish, you're talking, answering the voices in your head. Or you're watching the street lampposts fly around the
mm-hmm.
The sky, and it scares people.
And we wouldn't recognize that because we are not suffering from that.
We're not suffering from that.
In reading the bits that I have here, it's touching, and it suggests that it asks the question. What does the family member who is not affected by with that disease, what they have to go through, and this child feeling the need to defend
right.
and speak out, and that is a reality, even though it's fictitious, the book is, but I'm thinking, wow.
That's what a lot of kids do. If the parents are alcoholic or drug addicts,
mm-hmm.
Kids step up at remarkably young ages, and in a lot of cases, it's not universal, but in a lot of cases, and take on the parental role.
Mm-hmm.
I had some friends when I was in college. They had a child. Well, she had a child out of wedlock when she was very, very young. And when I met him, the kid, he was about six, and he was like six going on 45. He was the one in the family that was the most together because he had to be.
Yeah.
Kids can really rise to the occasion if they have to.
One of the other things that I thought your book was quite interesting, it allows us, though it's fictitious,
mm-hmm.
it gives us an insight as to what goes on in a family, because we really can't understand that, and we don't have... How often can you sit down and talk to someone that has schizophrenia?
That's the other thing I wanted to mention when we were talking about some of the homeless people who are schizophrenic or mentally mm-hmm. ill on the street, and people are afraid of them, and it's part of the fear is just, visual. The other part is it's extremely difficult to communicate with them,
mm-hmm.
Especially if they're, in a psychotic episode or extremely ill. So mm-hmm. that's another thing that scares people, but
yeah,
back to your point.
This is what I got from this book and reading, where you're an advocate for the people that are, this book is advocating, is sort of suggesting that we, quote, normal people need to become a little more compassionate and more understanding, and you're giving us a reason.
Well,
I read that one example after the other, and I'm thinking, wow, this is enough to change your thinking, at least to maybe... You want to, let's send several copies to our city leaders and our state people.
That's not a bad idea, the police.
I'm reading this, and it walks them through. These are human beings with everyday problems like you and I, and your book suggests that, and it goes into that, and I would never have the opportunity to sit down and know a family that would openly talk about it or share with me. So,
well, thank you. That's a high compliment. And I think that was sort of in the back of my mind
mm-hmm.
When I wrote this book. But as I got to know more people, and, having a close friend with
mm-hmm.
he's the responsible one in his family, pretty much takes care of his schizophrenic brother,
mm-hmm.
You do develop a lot of compassion, and you do learn that these are real people with an illness that they didn't ask for,
mm-hmm.
didn't bring on themselves, and they have families that love them. And that was hammered home in the news not that long ago when the on a horrible incident in California, Southern California, where the police ended up beating a schizophrenic man to death, trying to arrest him because they didn't realize he was mentally ill, and he was fleeing from them because he had this illness. And his family was just devastated. He had an extended family who loved him and cared for him. And, I just want people to be compassionate. And one of the most gratifying things is comments like yours. And I have been posting it on Facebook, excerpts, as well as on my webpage, terrymorgan.net.
Mm-hmm.
And the best response I've gotten are from people who I didn't know had schizophrenic relatives.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just saying, thank you. This has really touched my heart. I have a nephew who's schizophrenic, or I have a loved one in my family. They didn't elaborate. And that's made me feel good, because, a novel, you want to entertain people, but you want to inform them. I mean, people can learn. And I tried not to write it as a nonfiction book and talk about things, but I hope some of the message comes across as revealed through the novel. And I hope people are entertained.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to The Carol Cox Show, and my guest is Terry Morgan, TerriMorgan, and she wrote, the author of Playing the Genetic Lottery, and you can find it at terrymorgan.net, and I believe that it makes for good reading, and that it has a human side to it. It isn't just entertainment. And it, though it's fictitious,
it is.
But you're connecting all of the, you're taking a family, and you're bringing it to us. And who's to say these things aren't duplicated in a real person's life? And it may not be in the trailer park, but there's one event where the mother, how drastic things can be, or things can change so quickly when they have an episode. You mentioned the father had gotten ill, had an event.
Right.
And the mother decided to save money, move into a trailer park, into a trailer.
Into a trailer, yeah, because the father was hospitalized.
And when I read that, I thought, okay, so what happens? The people that we see out there living in their cars and their trucks, what are we really seeing?
We're seeing people that often circumstances beyond their control, has plunged them into poverty, and they have no other option.
Mm-hmm. And so, your book, I'm hoping many people would read it or give attention to it, and that it will give us an understanding what we think we know about the homeless and what we think we know about mental illness that we see on the streets will become a little more sensitive. And I think your book will do that.
Well, thank you.
I really do, because I would never have given that much thought, because I don't know where to start, you know. And sometimes you approach some of the homeless and you see them, and I've on occasion, and you never know what's right or wrong. And
right.
On one rainy night, I remember, I'm there and it's cold, and I see this lady, and she's there talking to herself and having conversation. And I decided, I'll go get her some food. And I quickly run into the restaurant and asked them if they could, and they put it together, and I went out and I handed it to her, and she knocked it out of my hand.
Yeah, that happens. They're not in reality. And
yeah, and so I didn't go away thinking that she was mean. I began to understand that
she was very, very ill.
Ill.
Yeah.
And while one may argue or debate, well, maybe her pride. No, it was, and then she then continued to have conversation about the many things that she was talking about. And for me, not knowing what schizophrenia is, and our state government and our government just thrust these people out on the streets because the hospitals are filled. They're not getting proper care, medical care, medicine. Your book is, I believe it's very timely, and again, it's you're probably going to help a great many people through reading this, I believe.
Thank you.
And I hope that's the case.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, and, you know, and then you can, with your millions, you can come back to Hawaii and open up a clinic and a facility.
That would be great.
I help you spend your money.
No, one of my goals is now that the book is out, is I'm going to send samples to a lot of the schizophrenic societies, you know, schizophrenia.com, people where people can go for help, and ask them to put it on their website and offer to, you know, donate a percentage of the sales mm-hmm. to their organizations, because it is a it's a huge problem. I mean, yeah. I read somewhere when doing my research that more hospital beds are taken up with schizophrenics than any other illness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very difficult one because people are resistant to treatment, and you can if they do start treatment, they'll start feeling better, and then they'll go, I don't need this anymore, and it's just a revolving cycle. So there's needs to be more research into mm-hmm. it, so better ways to help some of these people, because it's they have loved ones.
Well, you know, the I'm happy that I met you. As I said to the listeners, didn't have any idea that we were going to be having this show today or anything, but I met you there at Whole Foods. You were with your mother.
Right.
Just sat down having, I'm trying to stuff my face, feed my face.
And we were looking for a place to sit, and
yeah.
you looked like a friendly, approachable man, so
yeah.
we said, can we? And you just gestured.
But you can always know that. You can always, I'll share my seat with you. But you notice I mantled my food. I wasn't giving any.
Well, it's okay. We each had our own plates.
but it was great meeting you. And then when you tell me what you were writing about in the genetic issue, the lottery, and then you tell me you're an author and then your background, and then you say Radford High School graduate, and I'm thinking just that alone to encourage the kids from Radford, or if they hear this or listen to it, and other people here would be motivated and know what happened to one of their own.
Well, yeah, I
went off and became a journalist, and
I'm kind of hoping some of my old friends from Radford are listening, and they'll go to my website and use the email address
mm-hmm.
terry@terrymorgan.net and get back in touch with me.
So your email is at terry@terrymorgan.net. And that's T-E-R-R-I, not Y.
Not
Terry,
Y.
Yeah.
Two R's and an I.
Uh-huh.
terry@terrymorgan.net. So they can email me, and love to hear from anybody in the public who's mm-hmm. interested in schizophrenia or knew me at Radford. Love
yeah.
to reconnect.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm happy, and I I'm not much of a reader of this type of material, but when I look at it in the parallels and what the benefits, I think a person reading it, if someone picked this up, I guarantee you they'll have a difficult time reading straight through it, because there's some touching moments in there, and I was reading and think, wow, I remember an auntie.
Ah.
Who was like that, and I'm thinking, wow, this explains how maybe, now, I don't
possibly.
Know, I'm not diagnosing her after the fact, but it began, I couldn't read sentence for sentence, I found myself trying to get through the first tab that you sent, it's like, wait, okay, that was my Aunt Mary, you know, this
yeah.
is...
Yeah. That's what I mean, it's so pervasive,
mm-hmm.
1 in 100 to 120,
yeah.
and it was underdiagnosed. And families were hiding it. We had my grandfather's cousin who lived with my grandparents was schizophrenic,
mm-hmm.
and the family was too ashamed to get her, put her in a hospital to get
mm-hmm.
her treatment.
Mm-hmm.
They did briefly, and one of the aunts went and got her back and just said, no, we just can't let people know.
Yeah. And we, when I was a younger child, maybe 8 and 9, there were neighbors. We lived in a rural area, and occasionally the son would go straying off. He would talk to himself occasionally, and he'd go straying off, and then they'd have to go look for him. In those days, you know, you could end up in the country and walking in the bayous or whatever, right?
Yeah, disappear in the swamp.
Disappear, yeah, and so all of that.
Yeah.
You know, and so reading this book, and it's like, wow, I see what was going on. So anyway... Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on the air. And I just want to add one thing. There are some bits of humor in here.
Mm-hmm.
Caitlin's got a great sense of humor, and you need a sense of humor to cope with life sometimes. So
mm-hmm.
it's not all sad and heavy.
It's right. It is. But it's good reading.
Thanks.
For me, I would like to look at and see when we'll...
Well, if I can get a non-reader like you to read it, I think I did a pretty good job.
Well, yeah. When you start reading the first bit, and I'm always taking life-like situations and thinking. I mean, that's one of my shortcomings in life, is that I'm always thinking about the other fellow.
That's not a shortcoming.
You know, but I mean, in this world, apparently, it's the way things, people are being treated. It leaves you as if you're the odd man out. But it's okay to care.
Yeah, it's okay to care. caring is good.
Yeah, anyway, Terry, thank you. Oh. I appreciate it. And how long are you going to be in town?
I'm heading back to Santa Cruz on Tuesday.
Okay, well, you're going to be able to keep in touch with us.
Definitely.
And I'll put a link to the book. And the title, again, is Playing the Genetic Lottery. You can pick it up at terrymorgan.net, T-E-R-R-I, Morgan, M-R-G-A-N.net. And thank you. And next week, we're going to be talking about the Canadian, they call it the Holocaust, where the native people, the children, were taken to the schools, the boarding schools. And I'm going to have Mr. Annette, Kevin Annette, and I think you might quite will be interested in this, and the suspect that many of these kids were killed. And he'll be on next Sunday. Aloha and thank you. I appreciate you joining me.